Good evening and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content by and for queer and trans communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and today I'm talking with David Duffield with the Colorado LGBTQ History Project. Housed within the LGBTQ Center in Denver, the History Project aims to collect and preserve oral histories and documents while also focusing on education and networking on issues related to LGBTQ history. David was recently awarded Denver Public Library's Eleanor Gears Award, which honors people and organizations who have made significant contributions to the library in terms of material, such as written histories or photos. David, thank you so much for joining me on Outsources tonight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Could you just start by introducing yourself and feel free to share any parts of who you are that feel relevant and meaningful to you right now, or things you'd like listeners to know about you?
My name is David Duffield. I'm the creator and coordinator for the Colorado LGBTQ History Project, as well as a teacher in Denver Public Schools. I've been a historian at the center on Colfax now for almost 9 years, and it's been my privilege and life's work to work on the queer history of Colorado.
So as you mentioned, the Colorado LGBTQ History Project is nearly 10 years old. Could you give us a kind of maybe the current state of the project and what it's focused on and what its efforts are right now?
Yeah, we're focusing a lot on what I term legacy items. So for example, creating more foundational committees for document and oral history, archiving and preservation, as well as working with schools to do our very first art competition on queer history in Colorado. In addition, we continue to offer a group on transgender history in Colorado called the Matt Cayley History Committee, and various other groups to explore intersectional identities from different groups.
I'm curious for you how you've engaged in over these years, just thinking about that priority that you've stated around representing the breadth of LGBTQ histories and identities, you know, diversity in stories that are represented in the archive, acknowledging that there are margins within the margins, so to speak, of LGBTQ communities and shared histories. So what has it meant to you to kind of think about how you engage that with adding to the archive and how you go about finding collections that are, you know, potentials to add?
We must always remember that our voices are the path to liberation for other people. When we tell the story of another, we share their story with others, not simply in the act of telling the story, but in the process of passing down the lessons of their lives. It's based in the idea of continuing to tell diverse stories as much as possible. With the Matt Cayley History Committee, for example, we created that in, I want to say, 2018, after Trump started his ban on the military, and it was in direct response to that. I put out a call for a history committee, and I had the idea of forming intersectional committees within the History Project to address specific types and stories and vignettes which had not been done before. So we named it after Matt Cayley, who was a wonderful professor. He passed in 2015, trans man who was very much a pioneer and a leader in the trans community of Denver and certainly the United States. The MKHC has done a lot of remarkable work. We've done presentations on gender nonconformity and transgender identities throughout African diasporic cultures, as well as with pre-Columbian cultures with the University of Colorado at Denver and several other groups. We launched the first tours of transgender history in Capitol Hill with our last night and first rally for Irene DeSoto, which is the story of a community response to the murder of a gender nonconforming person. And then we have done some really interesting archival work in oral histories with folks within the trans community. But I think the lasting contribution has been to establish that the history exists and that the history can be built upon and shall be built upon. When we bring those greater truths and stories to the community, we carry forth something which has not only not been done before, but something which impacts those who come after us, which is legacy, which is the idea that to see one's hand in history, which is the whole inclination of projects like this, is to see one's future in the story of one's nation, one's community, and one's place in all of humanity. And I think in the larger aspect of things, it bridges a gap which is inherently part of history, that people who aren't part of the state or people who are not powerful don't matter. And historians have this odd, unique ability to shape narratives, and the narratives we teach ourselves shape our worldview. My mantra is that the words we teach our children shape the world, in so much that the words we pass down literally help them understand the world around them. But the effect of that is also that there is magic and there is power in language. So for me, the significance is that we're bound to something much larger than ourselves. We're creating and recreating the world of the story of humanity, which for me is one of the greatest pursuits of my life.
You talk so beautifully about, you know, how you see the work that you're doing with the Colorado LGBTQ History Project and elsewhere. And it seems to me that so much of this is about how those stories get passed on, how they get communicated, how those effects ripple out. You mentioned walking tour, and that there have been walking tours that you've written and kind of developed that relate to LGBTQ history. I wonder about how you approach something like that in terms of engaging people in these histories and stories as they're moving through the physical spaces of a city, of a neighborhood. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, how you approach that, or the importance of doing that and recognizing, like, these are connected to physical spaces that we walk through on a daily basis?
I remember the first time I went to Stonewall in New York, and I was with my boyfriend at the time, and we had a fun time, to say the least. But to walk into the street in front of the Stonewall around the same time of night that, you know, people were fighting against, and to be able to physically almost, I guess, imagine myself in the moment of them lining up across the street, or the first time I visited Gettysburg, or the first time I visited, you know, the United States Capitol, there's a, I don't know if the word surreality is correct, but I think there is a surrealness to the idea of having read about something for so long and then seeing oneself in it. One projects oneself into the moment of the past. It's like that scene from, it's the Da Vinci Code. So I remember like from that movie, The Da Vinci Code, where you see the past sort of in holographic form around the characters. And when I do a tour, it's a little bit similar. My thought process when I do that is, for example, when I was doing the Queer Capitol Hill tour, was to take the stories of the place, and there's so many stories, it's superfluous, it's ubiquitous with the world around it, right? So I could look at almost any building in Capitol Hill and discover a queer narrative. But I took the ones I knew that were most prominent and were most at hand, and I put them into a map first, then a script, and then I worked out details based on a little bit of background research I've done over the past 10 years. So when one takes the tour and one gets to 1540-ish of Pennsylvania, and one sees the, 1450 Pennsylvania, and one sees the Gay Coalition of Denver's first house in 1974, and one sees them standing kind of in that area, and one realizes the geographic place around it, one realizes they had easy access to the Capitol, or when one looks at the area around the state capitol, colloquially known as Sodomy Circle, where young gay men did sex work and people cruised, one realizes what the culture was of the time. When one looks at the Harcourt Arms and sees gay people living in an area close to Poets Row, but was colloquially called again Bachelor's Row, where there were large numbers of men and single flats, one gets an essence of why Capitol Hill was a safe place for queer people. Basically, that according to like historians like George Chauncey in Gay New York, his book called Gay New York, the apartments offered things like privacy, and they offered large numbers of places for privacy. So queer people naturally sought them out in droves. But that isn't to say that queer people didn't exist beforehand. I'm finishing my thesis finally after all these years, and in just the research I was doing this afternoon, I must have found three or four additional like famous LGBTQ people particularly women-loving women in history. But to weave those into a tour is to guide an audience through, imagine them through the architecture, the context of the space and time, and then telling the story of the significance of the building because it connects to the major events and weaves the history into the physical landscape. So it is to literally reinscribe into the area, into the geography of a traditionally queer space, as well as Bohemian and others, a queer narrative which teaches people by place the importance of the story. I've given probably a 24 tours at this point, and I've written three, some of which are groundbreaking, some of all of them have like an originality and a novelty to them, because I don't think anybody else has done this before. And when I was receiving the award for the Eleanor Geary's Award, the surreality of that caught up with me. That after 8 years, I've accomplished a lot of things. The humility in me tries to balk the ego and says that, you know, it's weird to have what began as a passion project from a sense of injustice and continued through a queer history nerd's delight of the work to a community, but to have relevant consequences now, so that much, when we look at the world around us, the landscape is ever after changed. There's no going back, to quote Phil Price from Out Front. There is no returning to the ignorance which we've had before, because we've asked too many questions and we found way too many answers. And in fact, I don't think that even if I would quit or die, or God willing, I got bored, and that's never happened. And there have been multiple times over the course of the history project where I thought, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. But perseverance played through. So I suppose those are the fruits of the patience that go with it. But to answer your question around the tours, the significance of them is literally reinscribing into the world the lost places and the stories of queer people for the benefit of heritage and posterity.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and I'm talking with David Duffield with the Colorado LGBTQ History Project based in the Center on Colfax. The History Project aims to collect, preserve, and share LGBTQ stories, in addition to focusing on education and networking with other organizations in the state. You've said elsewhere that you're a teacher by training, but a historian by heart. And I'm curious how you see those two passions kind of overlapping and informing one another. So as you go with deeper with LGBTQ History Project, does that change the way you think about teaching? Does, you know, teaching some of this stuff in turn unlock new insights for you and in how you go about searching for these stories or engaging with that?
Yes. So when I actually said that, I was not a teacher. I went back into the profession in 2020 with the emergence of the pandemic. It was a therapeutic life change for me to make a little bit more money and have a pathway forward. And believe me, it's not been easy. But teaching for me is now something that I have rediscovered my love for, and I continue to do and will for the foreseeable future do, hopefully until I retire and I get much better at it. But for teaching, that's a very big subject, especially right now because of all the bans coming out for queer history. And I currently actually sit on the board of the Committee on LGBTQ History for the American Historical Association. And my work for the board is to try to build bridges between organizations. And as a queer history teacher, I've been to conferences and I've taught how to teach queer history and I've written lesson plans and I'm currently writing like multiple curricula around things like the Denver Principles, which just celebrated its 40th anniversary. I'm creating a whole website based on that, as well as work that came out of the pandemic for globalqueerheritage.com, where we did work on LGBTQ history and world studies for teachers. But for me, the legacy of that, I think, is that, you know, as I get older, what I would love to do is teach other teachers how to do that. I'd love to teach a class on at a college somewhere how to do queer history to educators, as well as teaching queer history in general. But I think that as a teacher, the value of it is incredibly high right now, right? There's so much controversy in states like Florida. It's just it's outstanding to me that states like Colorado, New Jersey, and Illinois have really pioneered this. And I've actually tried to communicate with queer teachers around the world. So as part of my work for Global Queer Heritage, I started like trading stories with queer history educators in Scotland and in Thailand and in Nepal and in South America and Africa. And what I've discovered is that they're all fighting for the same thing. For example, Scotland became the first country about 3 years ago, I think in 2021 or something, to actually mandate LGBTQ inclusive curriculum. And the model for that, what seems to be the silver bullet for all of this, is really getting a group of people to act as a constituent group, to pressure and to teach and to communicate and eventually to do. And there are other groups all around Europe doing that right now, even though they're not there yet. So it's part of a global movement because queer people are finally engaged, not just in the global struggle, but again, there is no going back. When I speak with people as far flung as Russia and Japan, you know, they will eventually succeed at stuff, but it feels so isolating as one man on the face of a planet to try to turn that, right? To be aware of that. But then historically speaking, I need only look back to Magnus Hirschfeld and the success he had with the Society for Sexual Wisdom in Berlin, or sexual research, excuse me, which simply got queer people to talk to each other. When people started to communicate, that broke down the barriers to liberation from the oppressive systems, which had been entrenched for hundreds of years. I think the act of communication, again, is the act of liberation.
I often think about how we carry stories with us, like hold them close in ways that might give us comfort or resolve. I'm sure all the collections that you've added to the archives has been meaningful in some shape or form, but I'm wondering if you found yourself turning to maybe a particular story over the past years that you've come across, or something that you find yourself holding close.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's just so many, but the story which comes to mind frequently is that of Irene DeSoto. So we don't know much about Irene's life yet before the last night of her life. We know she was a sex worker here in Denver in the late 1970s. She arrived sometime between 1977 and 78. And in the context, historically speaking, of the society around her, there were several killings by the Denver Police Department for Chicano people, for Native American peoples, for African Americans, and for the queer community as well. Another sex worker named Tracy Levy was killed the year before Irene was murdered. The story of her life is obscured, and the story of her death is extremely tragic. Not only on the night of her murder, she was solicited by a police officer, tried to arrest her for solicitation of sex, and as she ran, he chased her, shot her, and killed her. But the greater what compounds that is that her body was cremated and buried in a pauper's grave. No one showed up for her funeral. Her roommate likely was run out of town. We don't know what happened to her. But what we do know is that in the wake of that, people aligned with people like Dr. Bob Janowski and Pat Gorley, who attended this march, and T. Shook, took it upon themselves and her friends to rally against the police. Now, there's a duality in the story, which is briefly told as the groups that had effectively been damaged or had people killed at the hands of the police didn't necessarily want to work together. They all wanted their own thing, so I was told. And that they didn't necessarily trust the queer community because, I mean, it was still kind of like fringe at that point. But when you see the photos of the Irene DeSoto march in 1978, and it's actually called, they formed a group called the Transsexual, Gay, and Lesbian Defense Coalition. And that's one of the reasons we know it's connected to trans history, because they use the word. Her friends Missy and Monique, Irene's friends Missy and Monique, went in face in public in the middle of the day with carrying signs like fight back against oppression. And while cross-dressing wasn't illegal at that point, it was still heavily stigmatized. So the rally is one thing. The allegory of working together against police violence is another, as is the earliness of that rally. But the legacy of that is, again, something very, very powerful. Every time we tell that story, we recapitulate the narrative again. We reinterpret it so that Irene didn't necessarily not die in vain, but we are reinvoking her spirit and her soul in the name of justice, in the name of her voice, which was lost. I was deeply saddened when I learned about her funeral and the fact that no one mourned her, the fact no one remembered her. But to say the name of someone, to recreate the names around them, is to reinvoke their spirits and their identities and their humanities, which were erased and taken from them, and is to rekindle that spirit of radical action to which we say no more. I think that in a lot of ways, when we first gave that tour, it was actually at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests in Denver in the racial reckoning after George Floyd's murder. Like, I think the second time we gave it, we had originally planned to meet at the statue of the Civil War veteran who'd been torn down. And so it was in the context of this tour, like, we couldn't give it a second time, so we gave it online. We were actually Zoom bombed by neo-Nazis who, like, came on the tour and started doing things. Unfortunately, we couldn't continue it, but we continued to do the tour. And I've integrated that tour into other places, but without the Matt Cayley History Committee, without talking about that, without my dear friend Emily Ferrofino Cocagno and our friend Jen, this would not have been possible. And so I think that that story sticks in mind because it resonated at such a time in the middle of the pandemic, in the middle of the George Floyd protests and the Black Lives Matter movement, that it wasn't necessarily about anti-policing, but it was to say this moment has happened before. It's not unlike when they first started teaching the Stonewall moments in the late 1980s, when people were continuing to do things like the March on Washington and rekindling those skills of pride as protest that have brought our community, that have brought humanity back from the oppression of the state. So for me, I think that these kinds of stories, no matter where they are, reteach us the things which have been barred from us, that some may have forgotten, but others simply may not have ever had the opportunity to learn, which is why we tell the story, which is what the passage of the culture is, which is the most ancient of human traditions. So they're all important, but I think it's up to each and every one of us to discover them for ourselves and to become the activist historians that the people in the community around us are today.
Given where the Colorado LGBTQ History Project has been, even the current context in which you find yourself, among others, doing this work, what do you see as the future of the project?
It's hard to say. I know that as long as I breathe and live, that this will be part of my life and my identity. I am working now to create legacy because I know that it's time to open up the project to permanently create volunteers and people in the community with the specific skills to push towards more fundamental things like a book talking about queer history in Colorado. And while history projects like ours have come and gone, the legacy is almost always in the volunteers. The Boston History Project, which is the oldest of the 30, 40 something queer history projects in the United States, has been around for almost 40 years. And they've continued to go because of the passion of their volunteers. But it's a community built upon questions. Right? Eventually, organically, it may grow into a permanent piece, right? Like, I might retire as a historian and, you know, pass on the title of coordinator for the History Project to someone else, or the idea is not to make it so intimately tied to my work that I'm not the only one working on it, but that we're fostering a community of people to continue to do the work.
To that end, and as we wrap up our conversation tonight, how can people get involved? Maybe there's some listeners who have realized, oh, they might have something important to contribute to the archive in the form of an oral history or a physical collection, or maybe people are hoping to just access this information themselves or better engage in Colorado's LGBTQ history. So what are those ways that people can get plugged in?
People can come volunteer. We have many standing committees right now that will need folks, particularly around oral history and document archiving. I also think that there's room to create groups for teachers and for regional committees or regional history projects. I had the privilege and continue to do so of working with Glenda Russell and several folks in Boulder, including my wonderful intern, Aurora Lord, I hope you're listening, who are pioneering queer history in Boulder. And we found queer history going back 150 years, a gay actor in the early 20th century, what was life like for homosocial spaces in the mid-20th century, and so on and so forth. And we've also partnered with librarians at the Nicole DeSimo, I believe, at the Carnegie Library. But the work of it is really the area that we have to focus on. We have to get people to volunteer and to do the work and to create their own projects. And it's a lot to manage. As a teacher, I work a 50 or 60 hour week. And in addition to my duties on Saturdays for the history project, I also have my own thesis research. The point of the matter is that it's a very busy life, which is why 10 years has seemed like it's gone by very quickly. But I also think that when we get people involved, the ultimate goal is to create a community around it and to get people who are passionate about creating a community of queer historians.
Been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm Sean Kenny, and I've been talking with David Duffield with the Colorado LGBTQ History Project. David, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For more information about the Colorado LGBTQ History Project, go online to our website at news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. There you can find links with more information about the project, including opportunities to listen to the over 115 oral histories collected thus far from LGBTQ people in the state. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about tonight's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org.